The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, proudly brought to you by APSA, Corporate and Investment Banking, the bravery to shine a light and the strength to keep going in this COVID-19 crisis. That's Africa Nascity. APSA is a registered FSP. Good evening and welcome to The Money Show. We'll talk about interest rates this evening. We'll then talk about what the Reserve Bank is likely to do as it wraps up so far 2 days of meetings. I wonder if in Zoom world, if they meet for as long as they have previously. Certainly research that I'm seeing online is suggesting that Zoom meetings are considerably more exhausting than face-to-face meetings. And for one, I think I can attest to that. I don't know if our sleep patterns are being massively disruptive or what it is, but the level of concentration it takes to keep a beady eye on a camera lens versus actually keeping a beady eye on somebody else's beady eye, so to speak, is considerably more tiring. That's what I find anyway. I wonder whether or not the Reserve Bank's Monetary Policy Committee has sat through 2 full days of meetings and will then wrap it all up tomorrow with its assessment as to just how big the rate cut needs to be. We'll find out why Mr. Price needs new capital. We'll talk to the chief executive of 91, Hendrik du Toit, about their maiden results. We'll talk artificial intelligence. We'll talk with our consumer ninja, Wendy Nola. And then if you've used the grocery app Zalzi, I'd love to know what that experience was like. They launched in 2016 and coronavirus seems to have played to their strengths. Have they held up their end of the bargain, though? Are they as good as they claim to be? 31702-31567 here on The Money Show.
Bruce Whitfield on 702. Call Bruce on 011-883-0702.
Now to Johan Els, economist at the Old Mutual Investment Group. Well, rates will be cut tomorrow. The only question is by how much? Johan, give us a number. What is your expectation?
My hope, rather, Bruce, good evening, is 100 basis points. I think given the fact that the economy is in such deep depression at the moment and that inflation is going to fall more than what the Reserve Bank forecast at their last meeting, that we should at least get 100. But I suspect that maybe they'll go for something slightly less.
Okay, now you've hedged all of your bets. Your next career, if economics doesn't work out for you, rugby commentary one day when there is rugby is your next career option. Give me a sense, please, of the inflation picture, because inflation has, I don't know if it's deteriorated or improved, but certainly expectations for inflation are considerably lower now than they were 2 months ago. Give me a picture of what our inflation outlook looks like, please.
Yes, the headline is that I'm far more worried about deflation in the SA economy than inflation. And over the next few months, we get the April number next week. That'll probably be 3%, down from 4.1 in March. And then we're down to 2% in May and June. And that's lower than what the Reserve Bank expected at their previous meeting. They had quarterly averages for second and third quarter above 3%. And in my numbers, that's going to be quite a bit below 3%. So that means in an economy like South Africa and all the other issues around quality improvements, etc., it makes it very difficult to say that we've got any sense of inflation at all when we measure 2%. And that demand destruction that we see in this economy is far outweighing any possible supply-side constraints in terms of pricing. So I think I would be, if I were at the central bank, far more worried about deflation than inflation.
Now, you've got to explain this concept of deflation, because as South Africans, we know inflation because it's bred into our DNA. We've been through periods of inflation over 20%. I mean, if you lived through the 1980s or the 90s, say parts of the 70s and 80s, you remember massive inflation where the price of goods go up at a stratospheric rate. This idea of deflation, where prices can actually contract, it sounds, as a consumer, incredibly appealing, because a washing machine that costs 5,000 rand this week might cost me 4,500 rand next month. And that sounds like kind of a cool idea. But ultimately, you get stuck in that kind of trap and it becomes almost as damaging as having high inflation itself.
Yes, exactly. So when we actually get to negative price increases, and let's just recap. We've had some of that in some categories in the late 90s. Remember when Trevor Manuel as part of policy reform in South Africa, cut import tariffs on a whole bunch of electronic goods. And the prices of those actually fell in nominal terms. So that's not impossible. We've seen some of that. But when actual total inflation goes there, you and me, we just wait for prices to fall further before we make that next purchase. And that is the danger. That puts off production, it puts off employment, all the circular effects in terms of the economy. So when we don't buy because we expect prices to keep on falling, that's, of course, the Japanese example, then that's deflation and that's the negative impact on the economic growth. And
so how does that play into the Reserve Bank's thinking as it sits and it meets today and meets again tomorrow morning, has a nice big lunch? Well, they'll have go to their kitchens at home because they're having virtual meetings nowadays, and then make the announcement on interest rates.
Well, that's why I hope for a 100 basis point rate cut. And I don't think we must actually wait till we get to the zero bound of interest rates before we actually consider real QE. By that, I mean US-style QE, where it's pre-announced, announced in terms of levels that they're going to spend in terms of buying up government bonds and the duration thereof. And that is the only solution for this deflation fear that I have. And I hope that is in their thinking as well. So traditionally, there's been this Chinese wall between fiscal policy on the one hand and monetary policy on the other hand. Central banks shouldn't finance government budget deficits. I think that Chinese wall has been disappearing slowly since the global financial crisis, and these are totally, truly extraordinary circumstances. So I believe that in South Africa, we also need real QE.
The Reserve Bank governor has been absolutely adamant, however, in his explicit statements about the fact that he doesn't see it as his job to stimulate the economy. It needs structural reform, and we're not seeing structural reform coming through in any meaningful fashion. He can be, quite tough when it comes to that Chinese wall. Does he have? But your argument now is he really actually doesn't have any choice.
Yeah, I'm worried that that attitude might lead us to a policy error in terms of not realizing the seriousness of potential deflation in the SA economy. And I mean, you've seen the forecast out there for GDP growth this year. If this virus infection rate peaks much later than the rest of the world, we might not be in the V-shaped recovery. We might be in the U or the L shape. That's a long discussion. But there are so many risks around in terms of the economic growth cycle, in terms of deflation potentially, that I think that traditional fear of hyperinflation when a central bank finances a government deficit, that's out of the window. The risk of policy error here, in my mind, is rising.
Thank you to Johan Els, economist at the Old Mutual Investment Group. Who would have thought at the beginning of this year that deflation, prices falling, would suddenly become a problem? I see today DJ Black Coffee not being held back by the lockdown, not one bit. His investment company, Flight Mode Digital, buying a stake in Gallo Music, biggest, oldest independent music label, controlled by Lebashe, which bought it from Tiso Blackstar earlier this year, I think it was. And DJ Black Coffee's got himself an investment there. Moving on to a story of a different kind now, and one that you need to pay attention to when it comes to your investments, because despite the surge that we've seen in the stock market in recent weeks, or maybe because of the surge that we're seeing in stock markets, lots of investors are really worried about putting their money into shares, particularly local shares. So returns have been below inflation for the last 5 years. The last 2 months, there's been that agonizing collapse in valuations before a very sharp recovery, which experienced investors are telling us that it may or may not last. Philip Bradford has got a different idea about investing. He is a portfolio manager at Sasfin. And mostly, Philip Bradford, if I said the word bonds, most people's eyes glaze over. But you're arguing very, very strongly that sometimes backing the tortoise rather than the hare can be a very valuable investment strategy. Take me through the thinking.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. Good evening, and thanks for the invitation. And the tortoise versus the hare story always fascinated me over the years because, why would the tortoise ever actually beat the hare? And normally, of course, the shares are like the hare, where they tend to give you very good returns over time, but like the hare, they tend to be a little bit unreliable. And the tortoise tends to be, you know, the steady and slow gets you there. And that always, I always thought was like moralistic propaganda in a way to get us to behave well. But actually what's happened over time is our bonds in South Africa, which, as you mentioned, are the boring kind of fixed deposits in a way, have tended to actually give us very good returns. But right now, given what's happened in markets, our tortoise is supercharged and is actually lined up to give us similar returns to equity. So you've just spoken to Johan on the line before, and he's told you inflation's probably going down to 3% and maybe even lower. And hopefully our interest rates get cut aggressively. I don't think they will too much, but if interest rates get down to 3%, I can still get government bonds today at over 11%. So, you know, let's say 11.25%. That's currently 8% higher than I'm getting on the repo rate, and potentially 9% if we get cut tomorrow.
Okay, now you've got to explain something to me, please, because a lot of commentators will say bonds are cheap and the yields are high. Let's take the first bit of this, please, if we can. Bonds are cheap in English.
Yeah, and I think people often look at it and get confused with bonds. But at the end of the day, like I said, a bond is like a fixed deposit. So if I go and buy a 10-year bond today, the South African 10-year bond is about 9%. I'm basically saying I'm going to get 9% a year for the next 10 years. It's as simple as that. And the difference is I can buy it and sell it every day, so the value might go up and down a little bit. Where shares, actually, the right way to look at it might be to compare it to a share and compare it to the dividend yield of a share. So a share might have a dividend yield of 3% a year, and the bond is giving me 9% a year. The big difference with a bond, though, is the capital's guaranteed and the income's guaranteed, and you know when you're going to get your money back. So if I buy a 10-year bond today, it's exactly like me going to one of the banks and buying a 10-year fixed deposit. I know what my return is going to be. The quick question I've got to ask myself is it enough? And when that yield is, you know, currently if you go to try and get a fixed deposit from one of the banks today, you'll be lucky to get 4.5%. If I can get a 20-year fixed deposit at about 11.25% today, that is almost three times what I'm expecting from cash over that period.
How then does a falling inflation environment, a falling interest rate environment, impact your thinking when it comes to buying bonds versus equities? Because traditionally, equities love low inflation and low interest rate environments.
Yeah, and I think it's similar to the discussion you had on deflation before. The question is, why are interest rates low? Unfortunately, inflation and interest rates are low because the economic outlook is very poor. And normally what would happen is when the economic outlook is poor, obviously you want to buy bonds because they're more defensive, but normally those yields would be very low. But because of what's happened recently on emerging market bonds as well as South Africans, the South African bonds are still giving us yields over 11 when actually they should be giving us probably something closer to 5 or 6. So if you have a look at Brazil as an example, Brazil is further rated below us into junk, and their yields are about 2% below ours, around the 10-year rate, and in the longer rates, even lower than that. So we're attractive relative to even the likes of Brazil, but if you compare us to the US 20 or 30-year bond, we're about 10% higher than them. So we would expect normally in this economic environment, bond yields would be much, much lower. But because of the risks around South Africa, our bonds have sold off to, you know, I've been in this bond market for over 20 years, and normally the bond yields were lower than the cash yields when I got into the bond market. Now it's the absolute other way around. And it's absolutely mind-blowing to think that cash is at 4 and bonds are over 11.
But we seem to think that bonds are a zero-risk investment, because what is the chance of the country defaulting? Well, in this environment, there are no blooming guarantees, especially not when it comes to whether or not a country defaults. The country's finances are in tatters at the moment.
100%. So there's definitely risk, and you tend to see some capital volatility. You know what your cash flow is going to be on the bond, but the capital can move around. It's significantly less risky than equities, though. And in an environment where South Africa does get into a situation, and even a default situation, if you compare it to what happened to Russia in the late 90s, what actually happened was the bonds tended to be relatively stable, particularly in local currency. But what happened was your currency blew out. So if we did get into a problem situation in South Africa here, and I still think we're quite far away from that, but if we did, the currency is going to go you know, we don't even want to estimate where it's going to get to. But the locally, our bonds, remember, are over 90% of our bonds are issued in rands. Our fixed rate bonds, over 40% of those are owned by foreigners anyway. And what they do is they buy our bonds, they love our very high yields, and then they just hedge out the currency risk. Okay. So if we got into a really bad economic situation in South Africa, our local equities, those are all falling 30, 40% easily, and our currency could quite easily lose another 20 or 30. But your bonds during that time will continue to pay their interest, because okay, what your Reserve Bank then does is it just prints more money to pay the interest.
Cheerful thought. Thank you, Philip Bradford, portfolio manager at SASFIN. But yeah, a worthwhile discussion to have. Thank you very, very much indeed. Jason, on the line to us from Johannesburg, you've got a problem with UIF claims for employees. Can you not understand the forms? What's going on?
Bruce, if only it was that easy. While we're in the liquor industry, which is, I suppose, is always thought to be in the tortoise in the assessment example, we employ 337 staff, of which we've applied for the UIF TERS, TRS claim. And it took us a while to get it lodged on their site because of technical issues, which I can understand given the massive response they've had. We're just concerned for the staff. So the industry hits as hard as ours. We rely on we need the funding the government has provided, and we have got our U-filing account locked. And so when your U-filing account is locked, you cannot submit your own declarations, and if your declarations aren't submitted, you can't get paid your TERS. So we've successfully registered our employees for TERS, and they've got it waiting there, but they can't push the button to give the funds to us to give to our employees until we've got the U-filing submitted.
I mean, yeah, so you're stuck. You're basically stuck in a no man's land. Is that the problem?
Yes, and the only telephone number you can get through to is the COVID hotline, and they're very friendly staff, but the friendly staff don't have a lot of technical knowledge, and the general response is to resubmit to the email address, which creates the technical, it creates more volume. So the when every call is told to resend, we've sent ours four times, that means they've got to clear four emails before they get to the next person. And there seems to be no support for the U-filing. So if our U-filing profile was reset so we could log into it or allocated to our group financial manager, she would be able to do the declarations. And if those are done by us, automatically the system would pay out. So I believe people are getting paid 24 hours later.
Okay, so it's working for some and not for others. Any tips, any advice for Jason, who's stuck in this horrible digital no man's land at the moment when it comes to UIF and his staff are bearing the brunt of it?
The markets.
Chris Stewart from 91. Another big day for the JSE. Another improvement in the currency. Chris Stewart, it's an expectation. Usually I ask you this question last, but I'm going to ask you it first. 50, 75, 100 basis point cut tomorrow. What's your money on?
Well, Bruce, it's a little bit more tricky than usual, I guess, this time around. I know the market is saying sort of 60 basis points is the consensus expectation. That's what's really being priced in. I'm only just in the camp of 50, not 100. I don't think 75, it's a little bit unusual, a 75 basis mm-hmm. point cut, not impossible. I'm going to say 50, Bruce, but I wouldn't be enormously surprised if we see 100 basis points tomorrow.
And give me also, please, a sense as to why Mr. Price, which doesn't obviously need capital, it doesn't have any debt, it hasn't gone gallivanting around the globe like its peers and lost lots of money in the UK and Australia and places like that. It has, maybe it's had a dalliance or two, but hasn't gone in the whole hog. Why is it raising capital now and quite a lot of it as well?
Yeah, Bruce, I mean, they've said today that they are looking to raise up to 10% of their shares, an issue that would probably give them somewhere in the region of 3 billion rands. And as you indicate, there's no debt on the Mr. Price balance sheet. The company is, a colleague of mine put it beautifully, allergic to debt. So why raise capital now? It's interesting. I was talking to one of the bank executives the other day who said to me, if anything good is going to come out of this dire situation we find ourselves in, and that is that well-managed companies with strong balance sheets are going to see tremendous opportunity. And I guess Mr. Price would like to preemptively get ready for the opportunity that is inevitably going to present itself. They've indicated in the release today that they are looking to raise capital for potential acquisitive activity. There's a few obvious ideas out there as to potential struggling South African retailers who might be on the block. Maybe it's not the obvious names, but certainly they look like they are preparing themselves to potentially pick up good assets at attractive prices.
And it is in times like this where deals are done. And we saw, I mean, Dis-Chem tells us that they launched their takeover attempt of Baby City, which they confirmed last week, before this whole mess sort of started playing out. However, I mean, they've come out with results today and, you know, they controversy around their rental payments. And they did say that they thought they'd been treated unfairly and they just wanted relief on 15% of their rental requirements because that reflected what they couldn't sell during lockdowns. But the Dis-Chem results, they look pretty solid. I mean, these are Dis-Chem clicks, good, solid South African businesses.
Yeah, I wouldn't describe the Dis-Chem results as quite as good as what clicks have been producing. A little bit of a miss, I think, versus the market's expectations. Okay. Earnings probably about 5% light of what the market was looking for. And I think the disappointment coming out of their all-important retail business where revenues relative to costs in the second half of the year, a little bit disappointing, negative operating leverage in that business coming through, also cutting their dividend. That's a trend we're going to see more and more of. Your previous speaker was talking about you buy equities because they give you a dividend yield. But that's no sure thing in this environment, and I think we're going to see lots and lots and lots of companies cutting dividends during the course of the next 6 months. So no dividend from Dis-Chem. The wholesale business looks like it went a little bit better. Cash flow management was quite good by the look of it, good cash flow generation. However, I think probably the biggest disappointment with the results was the guidance as to what's happened to retail sales post their financial year end. The March to May retail sales period looking a little bit disappointing, certainly relative to what has been thought of as a growth company, priced as a growth company, and you know, they're continuing to expand their footprint, but not really seeing the turnover commensurate with that expansion.
And then Tiger Brands issued a trading update a while back. They've redone their sums, and it's not good. Their export business really is hemorrhaging badly.
Yeah, they've come up. They haven't guided on headline earnings. They report their results early next week. What they have done is they've updated the previous guidance that they provided to the market, I think sometime around February, where they said that their earnings per share would be down at least 36%. And they've come up today to say that their continuing operations earnings per share is going to be down about 75%. So that is certainly at least 36% down. In fact, it's 75% down. That's on the back of some quite material impairments they're going to be taking across the business, their DaVita business in South Africa, their deciduous fruit export business, as well as their stake in UAC in Nigeria, all of those contributing towards an impairment of balance sheet asset value of 557 odd million rand. And if you bear in mind, last year they made an extraordinary profit on the sale of their Oceana shares to Brimstone. That created a slightly inflated base, and that's why we're seeing a 75% year-on-year drop. But the fundamentals for Tiger Brands still pretty difficult at the moment. I would expect to see further margin pressure in their all-important grains business and the market taking them down 10% today. So not looking favorably on that trading update.
Chris Stewart from 91, thank you very much indeed. The temptation to ask him whether his bosses at 91 are doing a decent job or not is there. But sadly, we're out of time. I'll ask Kendrick to toy his boss that question myself in a few minutes' time. We'll clear with the sports in a moment. But first, let me tell you that on your next Money Show, we will review the Reserve Bank decision on interest rates. Of course, in the age of COVID-19, anything is possible. It's been very aggressive in recent months when it has come to cutting interest rates. We'll see what they do this time. Personal finance expert Warren Ingram on how to recover your retirement. And Pablo Fatidis, the man with big solutions for small businesses, looking for tricks, strategies, and tips to help you cope with shutdowns on your business. Are you ready for level 3? How is that changing? And are you going to be in a position to capitalize when things start to, what's that word, get normal again? Next time on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to shine a light and the strength to keep going during this crisis. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP. 702. Bruce is on The Money Show.
Welcome to The Money Show. And so many business decisions get made in good times, not anticipating necessarily that the environment is going to turn really difficult and really hostile and really toxic for a long period of time. I wonder if Hendrik du Toit, the chief executive of 91, has been losing sleep over the decision they took to unbundle from Investec and to list independently in London and on the JSE. Hendrik du Toit is the 91 CEO. Welcome to the show this evening, Hendrik. Are you losing sleep? Have you regretted the sticking to the decision to unbundle when you did, just as COVID-19 was beginning to rear its head?
Good evening, Bruce. Good evening, listeners. I think I've lost a lot of sleep just in the work of the last 2 months. You know, we've been pretty busy, but we're happy with our decision, and I think it's the right decision for what, you know, for the Investec shareholders at the time of the demerger, and I hope the 91 shareholders feel that they've had a fair experience.
I mean, do you, when going it alone into this turmoil, does it have any advantages at all? Does it help you think differently about the way you're shaping the business of 91, the way that you will build this business into the future?
Because I'm a big believer of the nowhere to hide strategy. You've got to face the realities of the market, whatever it is, and a simplified, focused business with a high degree of employee ownership and accountability is a pretty good position or pretty good format to take on tough times.
Because your staff do own 21% of the company. I mean, why is it so important that they have a big shared interest in the fortunes of the business of 91 at the same time as clients who have a very big interest in the performance, the underlying performance of the investment decisions you make?
I think staff ownership, firstly, this is a human capital business. We combine human capital with the financial capital of our clients. So if we had too much own financial capital, as in a balance sheet driven business such as other financial services businesses, there may be conflicts. Also, if people are owners, they think long term. And long term decisions always support not only shareholders but other stakeholders, and in particular clients. So we feel that this is a good position, and we know in the industry, in the historic experience of the asset management industry, some of the most successful businesses were firstly independent, and secondly had high employee ownership. And the great successes of our industry are the partnerships, which were largely built in America.
And I mean, that's the model then that you must be following, because I mean, being free of the banking business now, you look at this as a period to grow. Do you do it organically, or will you do it by acquisition? Is there an opportunity for acquisition in asset management in this time?
I mean, Bruce, clearly, we didn't plan for the COVID pandemic. The coming year is going to be a very tough year, and we're in challenging economic times, not just in South Africa, but all over the world. So right now, it's about battening down the hatches. It's about looking after our clients. It's about doing our best to deliver for them and not really have lofty short-term growth agendas. Long-term, of course, we're ambitious and we want to grow the business. We prefer... And we've been growing the business from startup stage 29 years ago. We prefer the organic way. It's the hard way, but it's the sustainable way. If opportunities come past, you know, to acquire skills or people, obviously we do that. But we think it's very risky to go into major M&A or mergers and acquisitions business in markets and conditions as unpredictable as these.
I mean, and as asset managers yourselves, as people who look at other people's decisions to do deals, you realize just how many of those deals fail miserably and end up costing investors in the acquiring business a hell of a lot of money over a long period of time.
Exactly. And if you go and look at the business school literature, well documented, the acquirer often struggles and the person selling out often wins. So we just think it's a game that also besides the fact that it's difficult to execute and implement, I mean, for heaven's sake, it took almost 2 years to demerge this business from Investec. It was a simple deal. Fani and I were in agreement. The board was behind us. Just to get through all the regulatory and other barriers took a long, long time. Think of the complication when you buy businesses you don't really know. You think you know it. And so in that sense, we prefer the organic model, but we don't say it doesn't work for everyone. There are some firms which are brilliant. Look at what Brian Joffe achieved with an acquisition built empire. So we don't say it's just not for us, because we're a human capital business and we have to keep our people focused with minimum politics and be really focused on the big things.
Are you yourselves vulnerable to predators in this investment environment? I mean, the volatility around is, of course, impacting asset prices absolutely everywhere. You're a trading freighter. You're neatly packaged. You're nice and bundled up. If one of the world's big asset managers comes sniffing around, do you find yourself that you're potentially vulnerable, or are you harder to take over because of the fact that you've got a very committed and loyal and invested team behind you?
I think that will be what could be our shareholders must decide. But clearly, when management is one of the biggest blocks of shares and it is a people business, whoever buys will have to contend and work with management. And we see that, you know, we've always been part of a business, a listed business, namely Investec, and we know how to deal with shareholders who approach us.
I mean, but your ambition, your stated ambition now, is independence, organic growth, long term. That is, you know, and until somebody comes and puts a big fat check, of course, across the table from you, that is the plan. I would take it.
Exactly, that is the plan, and nothing has changed since we engaged shareholders prior to listing, and we want to give our shareholders a good experience, a good long term experience.
There we go. Hendrik de Toey.
We ultimately look after people's money.
Ultimately, yes. And good luck with that, because times are exciting and tough and really, really volatile. Hendrik de Toey, he's the chief executive of 91.
These days, The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield.
Email him on brucew@702.co.za.
Bedtime story time on The Money Show, where we go and find some of the best writing from around the world on issues around COVID-19 and then bring you just a small taster, and hope that you will be as motivated as we are to go and find some of these great stories, because we learn so much about the world around us in times of trial, tribulation, and of course, great, great difficulty. From the New York Times this evening, on the day that Elizabeth Martucci and her 11-year-old son were deemed to have recovered from the coronavirus, they emerged from their home on the Jersey Shore with some sidewalk chalk to sketch a message in the driveway. "We are COVID survivors," they wrote. "I thought I was going to tell everybody I had this and I'm okay, just to show people it's not a death sentence," Ms. Martucci said. So she bought T-shirts that said COVID survivor, anticipating that some of her neighbors in the cul-de-sac at Cape May Courthouse might have some lingering comfort as a result. Well, Ms. Martucci soon learned that she had drastically underestimated the anxiety she and her son Marcus would encounter. Even now, a month into their recovery, some neighbors have cut and run. As soon as those that have been stricken with the virus emerge from hospitals or from home quarantine, they're forced to navigate a world that is clearly not yet ready to welcome them back into a still sheltering society. There are still many unanswered questions about the efficacy and duration of any post-virus immunity, and the uncertainty that has caused some people who have survived the illness to confront a fear-driven stigma from the outside world. The veterinarian who refused to treat a recovered woman's dog, the laundromat worker who jumped at seeing an elected official whose illness had been reported in the local news, the gardener who would not trim the hedges outside a recovered man's home, the neighbour who dropped off soup and said not to bother returning the Tupperware it was in, and the sick teenager whose solace during his long illness was thought to of fishing with friends, only to find them ghost him when he recovered. My gut thought was not, oh, people will be afraid because I had the virus, said Ms. Martucci, who described a neighbor tripping over a curb while running for her door when she and her son approached on their bicycles. It didn't even occur to me being shunned. You look at it as contagion versus as a survivor. Feeling stigmatized is not what many survivors said they expected after their tough bouts of illness. It carries a particular sting given the worldwide discussions about reopening society and how it will hinge in part on people with antibodies being able to return to work, and about how those who have recovered can donate convalescent plasma for experimental treatments for those who are sick. That is just one of tonight's tasters of a smorgasbord of delightful tales we have for you in our Money Show Global View this evening.
702.
Bruce is on the Money Show.
On to our second story this evening of our COVID-19 focused tales from the front lines from the Guardian newspaper. And it follows on a previous account of a GP from Edinburgh, a guy called Gavin Francis. And he talked about how he and his practice have dealt with the escalating crisis since lockdown. By the time the schools were closed in late March, my GP consulting room in Edinburgh had been emptied of all clutter, its services rendered easy to wipe down with disinfectant. It felt as if the decks had been cleared. There were almost 4,000 patients at my practice on the south side of the city, close to the university. As the lockdown began, my colleagues and I were spending our time phoning 200 or 300 of the frailest, as well as 30 or so that had been advised by government to shield from the virus until July at least. On the phone, we made sure they understood the advice to stay in, and they'd arranged food deliveries for the coming weeks. We checked that they had key information summary and electronic précis of their principal medical issues available for paramedics, A&E and hospital staff to access should they become unwell. In the first few weeks of the year, the pandemic had been dreaded but distant anxiety. I had little sense how severely it would hit us and how much planning would be enough. The speed of its arrival was startling, and the past 6 or 7 weeks have been unlike anything I have known in general practice. Everything about the way we work has been transformed. The number of face-to-face encounters with patients has dropped by 90%. Home visiting is both more time-consuming because of the requirement for personal protective equipment and perfunctory to cut contact time. Dread has given way to fatigue, but not to complacency. I'm worried that too few people are being tested, that the test itself is often inaccurate, and that our PPE provision is inadequate. The health gap between rich and poor, already wide from a decade of cuts to councils and benefits, is being stretched even wider. Now that restrictive lockdown measures are starting to be eased, cases will surely climb. My GP colleagues and I have seen some patients with COVID-19, but because of the effectiveness of the lockdown, fewer than forecast in those dark days of March. Two of our patients have died of it, about the same proportion, 1 in 2,000, as have so far died of the virus nationwide. The agility of the NHS in response to the crisis has been impressive. Our practice has 4 GPs and 2 nurses. All still travel to and from the clinic every day, and the 4 receptionists are still fielding and triaging calls. The appointments book is filled as usual, but now with names for the clinicians to phone back rather than with appointment times for patients to come in. The NHS is notorious for its slow uptake of technology. I still use fax machines and pagers daily, but now we text patients' phones to it with a link to open a video call to our aged desktop PCs. There's still clinical problems for physical examination, which is imperative. Those I do at the practice if the patient is fit enough to come in, and at their home if they are not. Either way, I wear a mask, an apron, a visor, 2 pairs of gloves. As aspiring GPs, we were taught to value the subtleties of human communication, to carefully attend to body language, to silences, to the way a patient holds or evades eye contact. In a mask and visor, I feel like less like a GP than an old-school surgeon, oblivious and insensitive. I mean, just the use of language and the beauty of the language and the trauma that medical professionals are going through. This is a GP from Edinburgh called Gavin Francis. It's a long read if you've got the time to do it. Go and search the Guardian website for the writings of Gavin Francis.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield
on 702
for the curious
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show is proudly brought to you by APSA, Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to shine a light and the strength to keep going in this COVID-19 crisis. That's African Asset. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to the Money Show. Talk to Cliff DeWitt this evening. He's Chief Technical Officer, co-founder at Dexterity Digital. We want to talk about Fourth Industrial Revolution. And it's a good day to be talking about it because there's a fabulous story today. And you've heard of the Naspers Foundry. Hopefully you have by now. This is a business incubator within Naspers, which has got a big bundle of cash, 1.4 billion rand. And it's making it available to investments that it believes have got growth opportunity into the future. One of its investments last year was Aisha Pandor's fabulous Sweep South, and they're going through a tough time right now. They really are, because the 15,000 women and the handymen are not allowed to get back to work now, but certainly domestic workers under current lockdown conditions can't, and so it's really difficult for them under the current circumstances. But they've had raised money and they've found mechanisms to at least provide some income for the women who use the platform in order to become self-employed effectively over time. Well, Naspers today announcing a 100 million rand investment into a business called Aerobotics, and this is this wonderful area called agri-tech, early stage business. But what they do is they mount cameras onto drones, and they are able to map agricultural fields. They're able to map orchards, for example, or in the plains of the United States, go across vast tracts of land in far less time than it would take you to do. If you've got a microlite or something like that, you might be able to have the same sort of effect, but you wouldn't have the tech that these drones have on board to help you find problems and identify problems. And this company is founded by a guy called James Patterson and Benji Meltzer. They've been around for the last 6 years or so. And it's this application of AI in agriculture. And they are able to help their clients with tree counts. If there's a missing tree or a sick tree, for example, the sizes of trees, the progression of fruit, for example, trying to understand the yields, for example, in fields. And they can do it a lot more effectively and a lot more accurately than current, than the old-fashioned way of a bit of a thumb suck and depending which way the wind's blowing. So artificial intelligence is becoming increasingly important in helping farmers understand the world. And these guys getting this wonderful 100 million rand investment coming in, it really is going to be very, very welcome. Sweep South last year managed to raise 30 million rand, and that allowed them to expand from being a platform for domestic workers to creating a brand new platform for the plumbers and for the service industry, if you like, for people who are electricians and people who want to know, you know, can the guy tile in a straight line or can the person plumb accurately? All of this coming up this evening, of course, and hopefully we'll talk to the founders of Aerobotics very soon.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702. For the curious.
Cliff DeWitt is CTO and co-founder of Dexterity Digital. So, Cliff, I mean, artificial intelligence is so broad and so all-encompassing and so wide. Is there a narrow definition as to what it is exactly? Just smarter than people. What is AI?
Hey, Bruce, good evening. Nice to be with you. Yeah, I thought it'd be an interesting subject to talk about tonight because it seems like everybody's talking about it and it kind of pops up everywhere. But I thought we'd maybe just break it down a little bit and talk about where it's come from and where it is today and maybe a little bit of where it's going. So I guess in a nutshell, it really is the ability for computers to learn. And maybe just a little step into history. You know, computers have been classically programmed since they were built by humans. So really the job of a computer programmer was to tell the computer what to do. And it's very, very good at doing that. So you write a program and the computer very diligently obeys you. It does exactly what you tell it to do. Which is fantastic if you want to do things like accounting or adding up numbers or things like that. But what happened was we started to kind of look at computers and say, well, hang on, let's look at the way we work. You know, a human is very capable with some learning to be able to tell the difference between an apple and an orange, for instance. You know, you can teach a young child to understand the difference between those two. But to do that in a computer program in a traditional way is very, very difficult because our brains deal with, you know, all of these nuances of, well, is it slightly round? Is it green, but it still looks like an orange? Does it have the right texture? And to kind of cognitively understand that and put it into a program is very, very difficult. So what happened was a bunch of clever researchers started to think about this and really turn the world on its head. Sort of started in the early 50s, but really got traction in the late 2000s, 2010 and 2012, when they started to create algorithms that acted very much like our neurons. And so the whole concept of computer programming really changed. What they did was, instead of actually telling the computer what to do, they created what was effectively a very small artificial brain, and they taught it with loads of examples what the difference was, for instance, between an apple and an orange. And the computer learned to tell the difference. It effectively wrote its own program.
Now, this is the freaky bit of this, Cliff, because basically humans empowered a device to, and the difference between thinking for itself and the difference for learning is fundamental here. It's not thinking, it's learning. And I love your description of it enables it to write its own code so that it constantly learns on the job effectively, right?
Right. So you get two types of worlds here. The one is where you basically give it a time to learn, so you train it, and then once it's trained, you take what's called a model, and then you implement that model. And in that case, it never learns anymore. It really just you've written the program, the model is run, and it's run forever. But there is a concept of reinforced learning or continuous learning where you're dead right. You take results at infinitum and you train the model to get better and better and better over time. And that comes with a whole interesting set of challenges, because there's a really good example that I like to use that a bunch of researchers, I think up in Washington in the US, did. They taught a model to tell the difference between different mammals. I think they basically looked mostly at canines. And then they asked the model to predict a whole bunch of animals, and it did a really good job. But when they fed it a picture of a husky, the model told them it was a wolf. And they were really perplexed by this, because they couldn't figure out why the model kept on telling them that it was a wolf. And so what they did was they wrote some clever code to tell the model, what is it using to actually identify that this picture of a husky is a wolf? And when the model came back and showed them what it was using to identify it, it said, well, every picture that has snow in it is a wolf. And that's because when they trained it, every picture that they'd fed it of a wolf was in snow, and none of the pictures of huskies were in snow. So and this is the challenge with your question. And it's the kind of the fear of it, is that you don't actually know how the model is learning.
I mean, if you taught a seven-year-old basic principles of mathematics and you deliberately taught them the wrong thing for a year, you destroy their ability to learn ever again, I think, in the human mind. And the risk of AI mislearning down the way, because it doesn't have an autocorrect, it doesn't have a mechanism to correct itself, it simply keeps, I'm sure, accentuating the wrong learning that it's doing. Is that possible when it comes to AI?
That's exactly the challenge, Bruce. The problem of, I guess, in quotes, programming has now moved from have I implemented the thing incorrectly to do I have the correct training data, the correct representative training data to train my model to do the right thing? And there's countless examples of machine learning algorithms sort of with the best intentions being fed a non-representative data set and then making the wrong decisions. Now, you could argue that it's got nothing to do with the small little brain that you're training, the model. It's just we need to give it a very representative data set. So it becomes, I guess, the trainer's prerogative or the trainer's responsibility to do that correctly. But it can be hard, right? It can be hard to actually decide exactly what is a truly representative data set.
Okay, so now, so how then do we avoid mistakes happening in AI? Because AI is a wonderful tool, artificial intelligence. It allows so much of the mundane to be done automatically, and we're seeing artificial intelligence being used very effectively in insurance, for example, in speeding up the processes and speeding up the boring stuff, because AI is very good at doing boring time and time again.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think sort of where we are, if we kind of zoom into where we are today, I think some of the best use cases for AI are really what we call human augmentation. So something that's helping you make better decisions. I think where it gets interesting is when that assistance happens completely autonomously, where the machine is making the decision and has the actions that come with it. So I think where we are today, really, some of these, the way to prevent it is to provide the human with a recommendation, but still have some type of oversight before an action is taken. And you know, some good examples of this are kind of in the medical field, and I think it's very topical at the moment. Machines are really, really good at these specific tasks, as we've discussed. So you can train a machine learning algorithm, feed it hundreds of thousands of radiology sort of images, and teach it what is good and what is bad, and then start asking it questions. Okay, is this one a good one? Is this one a bad one? And there's some great research happening, for instance, at the moment around the epidemic, around the pandemic, to look at CT scans to tell whether A, a patient has COVID, or B, are there any other underlying circumstances? So is there any extrapolous information, like do I have a scan of his bowel, for instance, not directly a scan of the lungs, and is there any correlation? But I think to prevent it, the algorithm should give the human a recommendation and then still have some oversight as to when the decision is made on an action. And that seems to be sort of the popular wisdom, especially when there's consequences to the decision. I mean, things like Netflix sort of watching your viewing history and then recommending you a film or a series to watch probably isn't that important if it gets it a little bit wrong, right? But if they're misdiagnosing you based on an MRI scan, that probably is a lot more important to require some oversight.
I was watching a piece today, I think the World Economic Forum put it out, about the growing number of people who are going through initial job interviews digitally, and their first interview is with an AI program that immediately is filtering who is good and who isn't. And it's smart enough to map facial responses. It's smart enough to look for things that maybe people might forget, might miss in the ordinary interview scenario, because you might be distracted, you might be thinking of a fight you had at home with your kids before you left for work this morning, or whatever the case might be. But this artificial intelligence program is able to very quickly and automatically assess, okay, this is going to be the short list of the top 10 people we should interview face to face. Let's get rid of the 1,000 applications, the 990 applications that haven't made the grade. And that kind of stuff is quite scary.
It is. And actually, Bruce, it's a fantastic example, because Amazon has been experimenting with that technology for a good couple of years. And I think about 2 years ago, they actually reversed an algorithm out that they had where they found, after analyzing the data, that the algorithm was completely sexist. It was giving a much better recommendation if you were a male versus a female. And it was just because they trained it with so much more male data than they had female data. So again, a great example of how, with the best intentions, with the wrong data, you can still have very interesting consequences.
Absolutely, Cliff. I mean, when we look at the application then of artificial intelligence in the South African environment, I think there is a fair amount of experimentation and application of artificial intelligence happening in our economy. Particularly, I think insurance possibly is leading the way, because there are lots of yes and no answers when it comes to insurance, and there are lots of the original assessments that can possibly be done in that process. Would I be accurate?
Absolutely. I did some work with a large insurance organization about 2 years ago, and that was really pushing the envelope very far on that. And the economics just work, you know, Bruce. I mean, especially when you get into something like the supervised methodology that I was talking about, you know, let the algorithm make some initial decisions, and if it's, you know, under a certain monetary value, it's probably cheaper to let that algorithm make a couple of mistakes than elevate everything to requiring a person to go and look at the details of the case and make a decision. So under a certain monetary value, if the algorithm decides that it's okay, well, pay out the claim, for instance. But when it's over a certain amount, you probably want some type of supervision to make a decision on that, and let the algorithm give you some decisions.
But I mean, how long until it's a case of, no, clearly you're a bad driver, and so we're not paying you out because we've logged into your computers on your car's onboard computer system. It tells us that actually you've driven drunk 3 times in the last month. So actually we're dismissing your claim altogether, because our intelligence tells us that you haven't agreed to the T's and C's, which, you know, were on page 47 of the digital document we sent to your smartphone.
Absolutely. You raise such a great point. You know, as we automate more and more of this stuff, it's much more viable for us to actually understand all those T's and C's and actually enforce them, because machines are obviously really good at getting through tons and tons of work, as opposed to if it was all just relying on people to process that data, well, there's a good chance that paragraph 47 would never have been evaluated. And I guess there's pros and cons of that. I mean, it also leaks into all these privacy concerns that we often talk about. You know, did you actually opt in to giving them that data, and are they legally allowed to use it? I think one thing about this world is that it does require a high amount of digitalization and requires people to I guess, give away more of their data than they otherwise would. On the flip side, if the pros outweigh the cons, you know, if I opt into giving you my data and I really am a good driver and I get really great benefits on my insurance, I probably might want to do that. So I think there's very interesting business models that are going to come out because of this technology. The point is well made, is that those business models will probably be much better enforced than they would in a non-digital world or a non-AI world.
Cliff, always good. Thank you so much. Cliff DeWitt is the Chief Technical Officer, the co-founder at Dexterity Digital. I understand, certainly, artificial intelligence a whole lot more than I did before.
Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Our consumer ninja, Wendy Nola, standing by. Tonight's topic, Wendy Nola, credit insurance. When it goes wrong because of a UIF payment, it sounds complicated. Do explain.
I'm going to try and explain as simply as I can, Bruce. So 2 days ago, Monday, FNB Life, the insurance arm of FNB, put out a statement saying that they expect to approve about 100 million rands worth of credit life insurance claims by June. They are currently processing between 2,000 and 3,000 claims a day. And that's all good, and saying, you know, they quoted the National Credit Act, credit life insurance is payable in the event of death, disability, terminal illness, unemployment, or other insurable risks that are likely to impair the consumer's ability to earn an income or meet the obligations under a credit agreement. Sounds wonderful. Then I got a case from a woman who asked me to just call her Sam, who put in a claim. She is she's on sort of temporary indefinite retrenchment. Her company is not operating at the moment. And so she applied. She took out a 150,000 Rand loan last April from FNB, and she's been paying it off at 5,300 odd a month, which includes 480 for credit life insurance. It's not cheap, 480 Rand a month. It was approved, and she thought, oh, yay, they said it'll pay out for 6 months minimum, let's see how it goes kind of thing, and with your job. And then 12 days later, they cancelled it. And they said it's because she received a UIF payment, right? And I've listened to the call recordings. The FNB woman definitely uses the word UIF. Yes, I'm sorry, that's the way it is. So she came to me and she said, nowhere in the policy documentation can I see anything about that UIF payment, which incidentally, she said, I didn't apply for, her employer did. And it was just deposited into her account without her knowledge, right? And it was 7,000 Rand something, a third of her normal salary, okay? So I took this to FNB, and they said it's not UIF, it's TERS, Temporary Employee Relief Scheme, but it's essentially from the government paid to the employer and then paid to the employee, right? So it's not a salary, it's not from the employer, it comes via the employer, right?
But it's still income though, Wendy, and I could see how the bank would say, hold on a second, you may be unemployed, but it's not as if you're destitute, it's not as if you've lost all income. The purpose of UIF is to supplement where you don't have an income, you do have an income, therefore this doesn't qualify.
Sure, but there is a differentiation, because there in their response they are saying where is it exactly? They talk about it as money coming from the employer. That's right. In this case, the TERS benefit has allowed our customer to continue receiving a partial salary from their employer. That's not from the employer. And another thing is, it's only a third of your salary. So the credit life cover, according to the government, since August of 2017, they widened the definition to cover things like short pay and being forced to be on unpaid leave. But she's getting she can't pay, she cannot pay that 5,000 or whatever a month. It's just absolutely not on a third of her salary. And the point is that nowhere did it say in the policy documentation that URF stroke TERS would cancel it out. So I've asked the bank, so how many people who apply, whose employers will organize TERS for them, are now not going to get that credit life? Because I'd never heard of this before, Bruce, and none of the press releases and whatever about credit life did this ever come up. They didn't answer the quantum question. But I think it's a very interesting one in terms of just another form of relief people thought they'd have, paying all this money, but no, because you get some government help in these extraordinary times, like a third of your salary, she can't stop paying it. It's mandatory. She has to keep paying that 480 rand a month on her loan as part of her loan repayment because it's mandatory cover, but she can't claim because of the CHERS payout. Yeah. It's quite extraordinary.
But it seems like this is something that nobody actually ever contemplated, that there would be this huge disruption, that so many people would be, put... on leave or effectively or laid off by their companies and that have to rely on the state, then they'd be on diminished income. It doesn't pass a reasonableness test in that particular case.
I don't think so. I'm going to keep following up on it because I want to see what the other banks are doing. But it certainly came from the left field for me and certainly for this consumer, most definitely. She's really upset and I can understand. I mean, it was approved and 12 days later, the bank saw this deposit and it came from her employer. So they said, no, you've got money from your employer. And then it was interrogated. Oh, no, it's a TERS payment, which I think should be in a different category. But, yeah, to be continued. Let's see where this goes.
And no word from the Ombud yet. I mean, this is kind of new. So I'm guessing the Ombud is yet to make any sort of recommendations or rulings?
Yes, I will certainly. Literally, I got this response from the bank about 20 minutes before we went to air. So I'm going to take it up with the Ombud and see how they feel about it. But to refer to it as income from your employer is actually not correct. It comes via the employer from the government. It's not your normal salary.
You're merciless. So, you're making people in banks work until 7 o'clock at night. Don't you know it's until half past 3
sorry.
Max?
Jeez, their fault, not mine. I asked them this morning.
Wendy Nola, our consumer ninja, the merciless. So Wendy Nola this evening, and that's why we like her.
The Money Show. Shapeshifters.
Our shapeshifter this evening is Butlari Valoy, founder of Zalsi, a on-demand delivery platform. You can buy pretty much anything in your immediate area. You get it delivered to you within an hour. And they call themselves the world's first digital mall. Now, an old story I found said they deliver alcohol. Butlari, have you got some sort of secret back door that allows booze deliveries? I'm guessing that's maybe just a little bit out of date and maybe you'll be reinstalling that particular function fairly soon. But how's lockdown treated you?
Yeah, it's been great, Bruce. And good evening to you, Bruce, and to all the listeners all over South Africa. I'm excited to be chatting with you tonight. The lockdown has been great for us, for the business. I think we've just been continuing what we've been doing ever since we started in 2016. And it's just been, the business as usual, but the growth has been great for us.
What was the motivation in 2016? I mean, what got you and your partners together to decide to launch an online delivery platform in an environment where online delivery is not, certainly not in 2016, wasn't exactly a national pastime. It wasn't a hobby that we all engaged in.
Yeah, look, I think, myself and my partner, Michael, and HP, so we've always been big dreamers, One thing that we noticed back then was groceries were not the biggest category, in e-commerce, and we didn't understand why, And for us, we had that big drive to say, how can we make this one of the biggest category in e-commerce? In fact, when we look at it, we realize that one of the reasons why e-commerce is not big, whether if it's in South Africa or if you look in the US or everywhere in the whole world, is because groceries are not online. And that's the reason why we decided to go into groceries, to say, how can we then transform this industry? And by doing so, then you can actually get the e-commerce industry as a whole to become big online. And once you do that, then people then get used to ordering stuff online, and other categories as well, it then becomes easier for it to follow suit as well.
What was the value proposition? What was the idea when you launched? Because each one of the big supermarket groups, as I understand it, have got their own ordering platforms. They've got their own delivery mechanisms. Did you simply slot into what they were doing? Have you substituted those in some cases?
No, actually, myself and my partner, we come from a tech background, right? So, in fact, I think we maybe were like the underdogs at the time, you know. I think we were very good with tech, you know. And one thing that we never doubted was we could actually build the best technology that none of the retailers had at the time, you know. So, for instance, what we started doing when in 2016 we launched, what we did then, we built a platform where you could actually replace missing products in real time, you know. This is something that was not there. None of the retailers were offering that, you know. So a customer will go into the platform, buy their groceries, and by the time you receive your groceries, some of the critical items were not there, and you're not informed, or someone have substituted your items with the wrong items, you know. So
there's nothing more from you. I mean, the thing, sorry to interrupt you there, Butari. I mean, one of the things that put my family off doing this was you'd order apples and you'd get bananas. We substituted. And it's like, oh, please, can you just not do that? And it's one of the great frustrations. I think things have improved since those days. But how would it work? Would I go onto the Zalzi platform and order my groceries through you? Or would I go onto a Woolies or a Checkers platform and order my groceries there and say, I'd like Zalzi to deliver them to me? How did that work?
Yeah, so we built a platform. This platform allows you as a customer to place your order from different stores. So we've got Woolworths, Pick and Pay, Clicks, Dis-Chem, Tops. You know, obviously Tops is closed now. Pick and Pay, Liquor. You go in there, you choose the product that you want. You can see the full catalog of what they offer in store. And then what we have behind the scenes, we've got pickers who then go to the store, pick the items. And what we have done, though, is we have actually... we allow our pickers to actually shop, like to communicate with the customer in real time. So if something is missing in store, they will send you an alternative in the app, right? They can suggest something different, you know, to say this product is not available and this is what we recommend. And as a customer, you can then accept that in app. And then the shopper can then continue to shop for the items. And then you get the stuff delivered to your door within an hour, which I think it's been great for us. In fact, to a point where, when we look at it, even some of the biggest retailers, for instance, started to approach us to say, hey, how do we work with you guys? You know, an example of that being Checkout 66, who came to us to say, you guys have built an amazing platform, you know. How do we replicate the same thing? And then that's when we started helping them, you know. And today, you know, when I look at it in the market, Zozi and Checkout 66 are, you know, like, I don't know, I'm not blowing my own horn, but I think these are some of the best work we've done, you know, when it comes to retail.
Because I look at the economics of this, and I then have a shopping list, and my shopping list requires me, because I only want Woolies milk, and I only want Checkers bread, and I only want Smirnoff vodka, I also, there's a nice bakery close to where I live, and I like their donuts. So I'd like those items, and I'd like them in the next hour, please. How do the economics work from your perspective to ensure that I get my delivery in an hour and you make a profit on it?
Yeah, so what we do is we've got different pickers. So what we do is we select, like, we call them hubs, right? So we would have a hub where we'd have all the stores, and the stores are very close to your customer. So as a customer, when you go into the app, when you search for, let's say you, first of all, what you have to do is obviously you have to select, you put your address there, and with the address, then you're able to see all the stores around your area. So those stores that you'll see around your area will be about 6 kilometers away from you. What we do behind the scenes is we've got pickers. These are young guys, you know, from all over in South Africa. Some of them were not employed. We took these guys, we vetted them, we trained them. And then these guys, their job, what they do every day is just to go to different stores, pick the items, right? So if you order from these different stores, what will happen behind the scenes is different orders will get routed to different shoppers depending on how much orders they have. Do they have capacity to work on these things as quickly as possible? So that allows us to actually work on your orders as quickly as possible. As much as you would have ordered from different stores, we're able to actually route these orders to different pickers who are stationed in what we call our hubs, you know. And the hub is just an area where we've got all the stores that are in the app.
But if I wanted five different orders, one item from five different stores, is my charge $45 for that one shopping experience, or $45 for each stop in each store? Because the economics of this thing seem crazy.
Yeah, look, I think you know, one of the key things is definitely like working on the economics, you know, in terms of like, does it make sense to a customer? I think one thing that I can say right now is we have managed to scale a platform to a point where we've done well on the higher LSM. And right now, what we're focusing on is how do you get onto the middle LSM to the lower LSM? And the unit economics definitely needs to make sense for us to penetrate that industry. So yeah, at the moment, you pay different delivery fees, but we have got a plan to say how can we actually make it a point where you don't actually even pay a delivery fee. You know, we believe it's something that's possible, and we've been working a lot more with different brands as well. So brands will come onto our platform to offer things like advertising, offer coupons, and we've signed up a couple of brands. Probably about 70% of big brands work with them very closely today. You know. And that allows us to offer like lower prices to the middle LSM going to the lower LSM. Because I think what we figure out is, as much as we're growing the platform, growing the volume, we realize that if you don't build something that's very inclusive in South Africa, it becomes very difficult for you to scale, you know.
It's a tiny upper LSM market, isn't it? And so therefore you need a mass market offering, and you are developing and on track for that. Vutlari Valoy is our shapeshifter this evening, the co-founder of Zelzi. It is an on-demand delivery platform. We're learning all about that. They and Checkers 6060 seem to have a formula that is working better than most at the moment. Are they as good as they seem to be? Your feedback, please, on 31702 and 31567.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. The bravery to shine a light and the strength to keep going during this crisis. That's African Nacity. Absa is a registered FSP. The Money Show.
Shapeshifters.
Vutlari Valoy, our shapeshifter this evening, a co-founder of Zelzi. Before this COVID-19 crisis hit, Vutlari, how many regular users did you have on the platform?
Yeah, look, I think before this, we're growing gradually. When I look at it year on year, we're growing at like 300% year on year, which was great. You know, in terms of number of users, we had like about, like, let's say 15,000 active users every month. We'll go in
15,000.
Yeah. So COVID-19 definitely accelerated things. When I look at even our projections that we had for even our investors, we thought we'll get to where we are today by next year, sometime in March, you know. So COVID-19 definitely did something in terms of accelerating the growth, which is great, you know.
And so how many active users do you have now?
So at the moment, we have about like 35,000 active users. Okay. These are guys who are regularly ordering on our platform. Like an active user, we define it as someone who orders on our platform once a month.
Okay, so that is exponential growth. And how disruptive was it? Because one of the great criticisms, certainly on social media platforms, as we saw the lockdown taking hold, was people couldn't get slots for deliveries of anything for weeks and months ahead. I mean, if you'd ordered a loaf of bread, I think, and on the 26th of March, you would have received it last week based on some of the delivery timelines that people were talking about.
Yeah, look, I think no one was ready for this. I think there were two problems. You know, first of all, is even the retailers were not ready. So you'll go there, you know, like a customer ordered like bread, but it's not there in the shelves. You know, so what it meant is every delivery platform had to make sure that you're communicating with each and every customer, replacing all the products. You know, but after a while, then we, you know, like, cause there was a lot of panic bias as well in the market. But after a while, then people realize that, you know what, we don't have to stock up the items and we must just chill, you know. So that actually helped in terms of, you know, like making sure from our side as well that, you know, we're fulfilling all the orders on time. And then we also added more capacity as well. What we saw as well in the market is there was a lot of drivers that were available. I mean, all the e-hailing platforms were not operating. So most of the drivers were out of job and they were looking for work from us. So we're kind of like, we started to have more capacity over a period. But in the beginning, it was very, very difficult.
I'm sure. I mean, how do you ensure that you keep with the delivery promise? I phone and I say, I want the five items I've forgotten about already, but I mentioned earlier, and I'd like them in an hour, please. And there are five queues, six people deep in each store. There's a queue outside the store now because actually it's a busy time, and you're not going to make the deadline. I mean, it's matching and meeting expectations in quite a stressed environment.
Yeah, look, I think one of the key things is also like making sure that on your platform, customers can track everything. So, you know, like so that they don't have high hopes in terms of like, am I going to get this thing in an hour or in 2 hours, you know? So one of the things that we have done is as a customer, you're able to see it in real time. You know, when a shopper is picking the items, you can actually literally see on the app that this guy have actually picked my cucumber or my bananas. So that actually helps in terms of on the other side, the customer expectations, and you can also chat to your shopper as well in real time. You know, you can ask them what is going on. I see you haven't started shopping for my items, and then they can respond to you to say, hey, like I'm still on the line or whatever the case is. You know, but also what has been helpful from our side is we have been working a lot closely with a lot of retailers as well, where we have dedicated tools, so some of their shoppers are allowed to go in and use the dedicated tools. That has been very helpful. In fact, when we look at it, it's actually helping the retailers because now they were able to drive more sales by allowing our shoppers to just go in, skip the line, and pick the items.
It's like Randburg Home Affairs, Vutari. You arrive, you think you're in the front of the queue, and you're not really because somebody's done a deal with somebody, and it's like, oh. But anyway, nobody knows it's you, so it's fine.
But it's very helpful we really want to protect everyone. We want to protect our customers. We want to make sure that people stay at home and they stay safe. And the only way to do it right now is just by shopping online.
How do you convince your customers of the health aspects of this? Because I'm now trusting Zelzy to do the cleaning stuff. They're going to two or three retailers on my behalf who may or may not be up to scratch in terms of what is expected of them in terms of health regulations. How are you providing any kind of guarantees? How are you managing our fear, legitimate fear around COVID-19?
Yeah, look, I think we're taking that very serious. So one of the things that we do is we make sure, for instance, in the morning, all the shoppers, all the drivers, we test them, you know, check their temperatures to make sure that if anyone is not within the right the temperature, we send them home, you know. So those are some of the things that we have done. And what we also do is we make sure that the guys sanitize their hands regularly. We provide them with shoes, with gloves. And in fact, you know, like gloves, we also recommend that, you know, when you use gloves, you like when you're done with the first order, you destroy those gloves, sanitize regularly. So those are some of the controls that we had to put in place. In fact, we spent a lot of time making sure that we train our staff to get used to the new norm, you know, and we don't know how this new norm is going to be with us for. So we had to invest a lot of time in doing that, you know. And to this day, I mean, one thing I'm proud of is we haven't had any case, you know, where one of our staff had corona. And the reason why it's like that is because we've been taking precautionary measures from the beginning. In fact, from February, when we got a news from one of the guys that we work with, one of the FMCGs, who said, you know what, like this thing has been taking over. We're not running a campaign with you. We then started to take this thing serious. We started to educate the guys who work for us about, like, what is this coronavirus? Why we should take this thing serious, you know? So from our side, we were, like, expecting it. We knew that it was coming to our country, and we had to prepare for it. So that helps us to... It helped us to prepare for what is already happening now, because it was going to be very difficult for us to train people if we didn't prepare for it earlier.
Vutari Valoi, thank you very much for sharing with us this evening. Really strong growth coming through in COVID-19. Lots of disastrous business stories, lots of sad stories in business, and a growing number of success stories as people who are well positioned for uncertain times are able then to grow their businesses, in some cases exponentially, as a result of the problems that the country and all of us face at this time. People who don't capitulate, people who make a plan and work around the issues rather than allow the obstacles to define what they're doing. They work around those obstacles, which is really nice to see. The story of Zelzy, this evening. A quick update on the currency, by the way. I think it's important that you get this ahead of tomorrow's interest rate announcement. To the dollar this evening at 17.94, the pound at 21.95, the euro at 19.70. Huge gains coming through, weirdly, ahead of an interest rate cut tomorrow on the currency markets.